This episode is brought to you by Southern Farm and Garden, a beautiful handcrafted agricultural journal. Purchase a copy today at southernfarmandgarden.com.
I'm HRN's Executive Director, Katie Mosman-Wadler, with a preview of this week's episode of Meat and Three, our weekly food news roundup. Kat Johnson kicked the season off with an episode about food and football, so now we're turning to one of my favorite sports, talking about cookbooks. We'll take a sneak peek at a few recipe breakthroughs that Rose Levy Barenbaum discovered while working on her 12th cookbook.
You know, so this was such a eureka thing. People ask me if I still keep learning. And yeah, just thinking about it and trying to find a better way. It happens.
And hear about the challenges of writing a book about alcohol from HRN host Souther Teague.
The history of drinking is very blurry. Because people were drinking and no one was taking notes.
Plus, we'll get all the expert dish about the most exciting cookbook titles heading to bookstores this fall.
Like jazz music, it's been a part of American cuisine for centuries.
Subscribe to Meat and Three wherever you listen to podcasts and be the first to know when the next episode drops.
All right, I am here in the Governor's Hospital facility on Madison Street in Manhattan, sitting with Jimmy Carbone, host of Beer Sessions Radio, owner of Jimmy's Number 43, producer of lots and lots of events that listeners you've probably been to. Thanks, Jimmy, for letting me come and track you down here in the hospital.
Well, thanks, Harry. Usually I'm drinking a beer when I'm on the radio. It's been about 3 months because I've been in the hospital, and I appreciate all your support and all the Heritage Radio. But Harry's been so good to come and visit me, and a lot of the Heritage Radio people have been... Been visiting me and supporting me, but I haven't had a beer in 3 months. So I'm dying to get back to it.
Is there anything else that you're missing that you haven't had in a long time that when you get out next week you're looking forward to?
Well, you've been pretty great. Last week you brought me Eli Sussman's food. What was that?
Samisa.
Samisa. That was pretty great. And today you brought me some Yugoslavian. Like burek.
Chivabi and burek.
Yeah.
From a restaurant in Long Island City.
I think it's just diversity of tastes, you know.
Sure.
From being sick and also when you're in the hospital, the food isn't really that. It's very simple. I mean, hospital food is hospital food. You know, it's cafeteria food, but just the different flavors. Like yesterday, there's a place called Woo's. It's a corner wonton shop on East Broadway and Essex Street, Lower East Side. They advertise it as a. My brain's going, man. Anyways, amazing dumplings and broth and. It's just different flavors and tastes. I think when I was first in the hospital, I was craving ice cream. But I was also craving in July when it was really hot, I really wanted some good craft beer.
Right.
And I couldn't drink that.
Yeah,
so.
Well, we're really excited to have you back at the Heritage Studios on the 18th for Beer Sessions, coming back. So we were talking earlier about the kind of the events that you do and the ideas behind Jimmy's 43 and that it really was about promoting other people. I'm wondering if this time that you've had in recovering, and I have to tell those of you, you guys can't see Jimmy, but he's doing great. He's up, he's walking, he walked all the way across the floor today so we could have lunch together, which is, you've come a long way, right?
Walked with a walker. I mean, so yeah. Harry, if you don't know, I was dealing with a spinal infection and had spine surgery in June. I'm really limited. I've been able to walk with a walker, and I'm not trying to not be in a wheelchair, but it wasn't a fun summer, but it's brought me a lot of realizations of just what I appreciate in my life. And one thing I found, whether with doing radio shows or events, I find that it's the stories, I try to make the story about the other people, that other people are really more interesting. Everybody's got a good story, but there's so many people, especially in New York City, doing food, craft beer, now cider, spirits. There's so many great people to tap into. They all have a great story. I mean, there's always way more people than I could interview or could host for something. But going back, we were talking about 2005. I opened Jimmy's Number 43, and at the time, I felt that the local food movement was really strong, and there were groups like Slow Food NYC, Edible Brooklyn, Edible Manhattan were really just starting. And it seemed that people were really aware of local food, buying locally, supporting farms. And it's changed a lot. But back then, that created an impetus for some new projects. Some of them were just hosting events where you'd be tasting, like Ann Sachs had opened the first American-only artisan cheese shop in New York.
Yeah, which now I feel like doesn't sound like a big thing, right? Like, it doesn't sound like a weird thing for someone to say, oh, I have an only American cheese shop. But back then, that was a big deal.
Yeah, I mean, we were used to getting, you know, the great, you know, French, Italian, and Spanish cheeses. And
but to really focus on the American was a big change.
Yeah, and Farmstead cheeses, which, you know, set her above everybody. She set the bar, but then I would do a tasting with her and someone, a local artisan producer like Rick's Picks Pickles. And then we'd have 6 Point beer, because 6 Point was the first new brewery in New York in over 10 years. In 2005, there had been only 4 breweries, and suddenly there were 5.
Yeah, right.
It's all different than now. But then that was, we were trying to just showcase what we liked. And it was also relationships, people that we knew who were starting out the new food and beverage businesses. And from that, you know, we did things like the Slow Food Snail of Approval was really important that back then to us. And it meant that we had to go shop at the Green Market in Union Square like 4 times a week for as many things as we could. And an offshoot of that was one of the former board members, Ed Yowell, who's been part of Slow Food NYC and Green Markets for a long, long time. We started doing events kind of in tandem with Kathy Irway and some of the, like Matt Timm, some of those cook-off scenes.
Yeah.
And with Kathy, she did like a risotto cook-off, a chowder cook-off. But Ed suggested, well, we wanted to promote Green Market farmers' sausages. And you don't really think about that so much, but, you know, at the time, like Patrick Martins of Heritage Foods was saying that to save the world, everyone should eat ground meat, which could also be sausages because you want to use the whole animal. And there were so many farmers, whether they were sheep farmers, pork farmers, that had sausages just at the Union Square Green Market alone, that we wanted to devise a whole event around it. And he suggested doing cassoulet, thinking that was sausages. Now we think of it as beans.
Right.
But back then, that was the first. And we did the cassoulet cook-off, and it became very popular, something that we've done every year for 10 years. And it evolved to becoming something that, like Glenwood, based in the Hudson, and some other teachers based in France came to do celebrate the beans.
Right.
So it really became
those great beans
a whole thing about heirloom beans. And it's kind of taken me through a whole. I've been lucky there's that. And, you know, we started doing offshoots, like a brisket event. Again, my friend Jake Schiffman still works at Food Network for a long time. And he, after we were doing these different tasting and cook-off events, he was like, we should do a brisket event. And one day we did, and it was really popular, and we had a bunch of barbecue friends, and I had helped Josh Zerzky do the first big Meatopia on Governor's Island.
Right, I remember that.
In 2010. So we had kind of this fresh crop of barbecue and meat-centric people. Okay. So after 2 years, we started doing Brisket King of New York City, which has really taken off. I mean, it definitely means something. I mean, 2 years ago, we had a bunch of Texas barbecue experts, and Aaron Franklin of Franklin's in Austin, Texas, came up, and Billy Durney of Hometown Barbecue got really involved. He won in 2015, and then 16 and 17, he was really instrumental in orchestrating the judging and some of the way it evolved. And but all those things started at Jimmy's No. 43 because we had an extra space. We had a back room. And it's kind of like the lesson of, in New York, if you get space,
use it for
something. You can do things with it. And I didn't really necessarily want to run a straight restaurant. I'd done that in the 90s. I had a little place called Muggsy's Chow Chow. And the day-to-day grind of cooking and kind of doing service every night, I really couldn't keep up with it. So I kind of wanted to have a place that had food, but also had rotating different. It wasn't really so much events as much as that other people could book things. So you'd have an arts group or a theater group or a reading group come in, and it was their night in the other room. And then people like, you know, Slow Food Offshoot, Slow Money wanted to first start having meetings, or another cool group, the Food Plus Tech Connect.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these are offshoots of Slow Food that had maybe people that more in the tech world. You know, they did Hackerati get-togethers and things like that I'm kind of devolving into. But, you know, the whole thing with it, there's so many people with interesting stories and showcasing what they want to do and giving people a place to curate their own happenings, I've always found
so interesting about that is that you end up with this sort of interesting mix, right? You talk about Franklin Barbecue and Aaron Franklin coming up, but then you have people who are new to barbecue or new to brisket who, you know, I'm sure have taken part. It makes me think of Pig Island, which just happened this past weekend, where you have someone like Rodrigo Duarte, who is not part of this kind of new food movement at all. I mean, he's got a butcher shop that is, he's what, third generation, fourth generation in Newark, but he's just been doing this incredible stuff, incredible charcuterie for a really long time, and now he's been coming to Pig Island for a few years, and he's right there. He's right in Newark. He's right across the river, and all these, you know, lots of people don't even know that his shop exists.
That's a great example. And Rodrigo's actually, he grew up on a multi-generational pig farm in Portugal. So he's brought over the old world, you know, charcuterie and butchering that they would have used in Portugal 100 years ago. Yeah. And that's something I'm really interested in, is traditional foods. I think you're doing that with vinegar.
Yep.
I see that happening. People talking about the natural wines. When you go to like a natural wine event, what you're really meeting are people that have, you know, longtime family estates, and they're going back to making wine and, you know, being natural practices.
Sure.
And the way they grow the grapes and their farming practices are what their grandparents did.
Yep. Or someone like Steve Wood with cider, right? I mean, at Farnham Hill, where he's really trying to focus in and remind people that there was a huge cider industry and lots of people made cider on their farms before Prohibition. And then it kind of disappeared because it never really came back after that, where beer came back, spirits came back.
Yeah, you know, and it took cider a while, partly because it's an agricultural product. Right. So we didn't really have the apple, you know, the varieties of apples that you need to make good cider.
Good point, yeah.
And there really wasn't a market either. But I'm lucky too. Cider Week New York, because of people I knew through New Amsterdam Market, when the first Cider Week New York was being put together back in 2011, I agreed to let them host an organizational meeting in the back room of Jimmy's Number 43. And then when they rolled out the Cider Week, they needed a last-minute place to do the first press and trade tasting. I also let them do it at Jimmy's Number 43, which was a great place to host those kind of things.
Yeah.
So I feel like since day one, I've got to be part of Cider Week. But going back to Pigalle, Rodrigo Duarte, you know, people often think of these meat events as barbecue-centric. And I've never really been a barbecue guy. I've got to know a lot of barbecue guys. But Rodrigo Duarte at Casiera Ybon in Newark, he's very interesting because it was through our friend Joe DiStefano. He's got a charcuterie masters event. And a few years ago, I hosted the charcuterie masters judging at Jimmy's Number 43. So they had like hundreds of different charcuterie products from all over the country that people had submitted. And that's kind of how I got to know Rodrigo. So it's like there's a mix of, you know, whether it's meat or cider or anything, there's so many different tacks on it. And yeah, that's what I love. I love discovering it and seeing new directions. And with the Brisket King event, what was really great, and I think the original idea with brisket was we thought of it as a kind of a New York kind of ethnic food. You know, whether you were Italian or Jewish,
right,
we all had memories of, and it wasn't
brisket.
Wasn't,
yeah.
I wasn't a barbecue guy, so I never thought of barbecue brisket. And I liked braised brisket. I remember having a memory. I was lucky that one time Sarah Jenkins, who's the Porsena chef, was a chef at one of my old restaurants. And one day I walked in and I smelled this most amazing smell. It reminded me of my grandfather. And basically she had just kind of braised a beef brisket in the oven. And she took it out and just a slice of that meat with the juices on a piece of bread was one of the flavor moments of my life. And I always felt that that kind of simple cooking is better than you get in most restaurants because you go through the prep and then it's kind of held. And then there's always some new process when they're serving it.
Yeah.
But this is what I love about being in the scene is getting it. The cook says, like Robbie Richter, who people know as he was the first pit master at Hill Country Barbecue New York, then opened with Zach Palacio, the Fatty Q in Brooklyn. I remember being, again, at one day Fatty Q around the time of the first Meatopia, and we went to see Robbie, and he was just playing around with his brisket. So brisket, again, just came right up. You know,
that
rested.
Was a fun place to go visit. I remember going and visiting Robbie back there. With the
and it came out. It had time to rest, and I had a slice on a piece of, it was a thing with white bread with this kind of chili paste. And those moments are always stand out for me. And that's why I love being in the industry.
Yeah.
You know, I love being on the backside of it, especially with the festivals or doing the radio show. I just love being on the backside, getting to know the producers and the industry people.
This episode is brought to you by Southern Farm and Garden, a beautiful, handcrafted agricultural journal. Each issue features stories about food history, seasonal recipes, artisanal products, and the amazing people who bring it to your table. Packed with stunning photography, the content is fresh and educational. Southern Farm and Garden takes you behind the scenes to meet farmers, gardeners, wineries, chefs, and artists who are passionate about creating healthy, unique, and sustainable food and products that you can enjoy all year. Are you interested in eating healthier and learning more about where your food comes from and living a more connected life? Purchase a copy today at southernfarmandgarden.com. Foodtank.com named Southern Farm and Garden one of the top 20 magazines for people who eat, cook, and grow, praising it for connecting readers with the food, the farms, and the stories behind our food system. Subscribe today or find a retailer near you at southernfarmandgarden.com.
Break distinction between your life and the stories told.
So I mean, being, you know, so the time in the hospital, obviously, you know, has not been easy, has not been fun, right? But it has given you time to reflect on sort of what happens when you get out, I'm guessing, right? And so, you know, what is the future for you? Like, where is your focus going to be? Obviously, you know, you're not yet back to 100%, so I don't think running a restaurant till 2-3 o'clock in the morning is in the cards for you starting in the next couple of weeks. You know, is it these events? Is it other things that you have on the radar?
I mean, if in an ideal world, if a few years ago, I probably would have opened a larger venue, something that could host events with outdoor space. And I kind of realized that that wasn't really my forte, that I really probably shouldn't be running a place. I feel like I'm open to a lot of new experiences. And I got really lucky this year. Last year, when I knew that Jimmy's number 43 was kind of on its way out, it did close the summer of 2017, I got into a fellowship. There's a foundation called Robert Sterling Clark Foundation, and they put together a group called the Sterling Network. And there's about 50 of us got selected, many of whom work for city government, some of whom, there's a woman named Rosmia who runs a fund for the public housing. She brought in a lot of food people like Liz Newmark, and they're cultivating a number of home-based food producers from New York City public housing. So there's a lot of cool things. You know, there's a lot of cool things going on, intersection of government and food. And I was on a Governor Cuomo craft beer working committee a few years ago with the Secretary of Agriculture upstate. And I've had some, you know, insight into the workings of government, how it can impact food and beverage producers. And I've been lucky through my radio show to talk to guys like Steve Hindy of Brooklyn Brewery, talk about zoning issues for, you know, food manufacturing. So I feel like I feel like for the skill set I've had and the experience I've had, I really do want to work more with government or with nonprofits that are working with government. And I don't think it's necessarily going to be creating events in that capacity. It's more about bringing people together.
Sure. I mean, it sounds like a perfect marriage of your behind the scenes and your knowledge of people and of the scene itself and of the food world and working behind the scenes to celebrate and promote others, which is exactly what
we're on the cusp. I mean, there's things like, you know, all these different food markets where people, it started with New Amsterdam Market and Smorgasbord, but there's so many markets. People love the pop-up feeling. Yep. They love going to market where they can buy 20 different food items instead of just being stuck with one restaurant.
Yep.
And that just shows, it showcases how many different producers there are in New York City of all sorts. You know, I still remember Jessamine from Hot Bread Kitchen and how she came on the scene. It was about 12 years ago, and the city really got behind her at La Marqueta up in Harlem. They really realized that this was not just a unique person who had great skills, but that there was a need for what she was doing. And, you know, she basically, immigrant women are kind of taught how to work in a bakery and take their traditional recipes and turn them into commercial ventures. And if you ever go to Union Square Green Market, see the Hot Bread Kitchen, there's a few things there that I love.
Yeah, there's some really, there's great stuff coming out of it. Well, I mean, you know, that, I think it's super exciting, and obviously, you know, I wish you a swift recovery, and, you know, and Heritage Radio can't wait to have you back on the air.
Thanks, Harry. I really appreciate you coming to see me. You should just hang out with Harry, and you should pick different meal for every day of the week because you're so great. You have such great knowledge. What are places that you like, Harry? I mean, you took the Yugoslavian place in Long Island City.
So the Yugoslavian place, and I'm gonna screw up the name because my Yugoslavian accent is terrible. But it is called Cevapcinica Sarajevo, and it's at 3718. 34th Avenue in Long Island City, and it's this little hole in the wall that I used to go to years ago when I used to do television work at Kaufman Astoria, right around the corner there. And it's great. I mean, they have, you know, these traditional kind of things. You're talking about, like, celebrating these traditional foods, and for me, that's one of the things that I love about New York. I mean, I love chefs who are pushing the envelope and doing new things and doing fusion and that kind of thing, but I also love the fact that, like, I don't have to go to Yugoslavia to taste what lunch might be like in Yugoslavia. I can get Burek, I can get the Yugoslavian sausages, and it's delicious. And then, you know, the next day I can go somewhere like Samisa, where I brought you lunch from last week. And, you know, those guys are doing it. Granted, it's their take, but they're doing a delicious shawarma. They're doing a roast chicken with these Middle Eastern flavors. They're doing a hummus. They're doing, they're doing pitas and that kind of thing. And Jimmy, you know, you pointed out it was funny that I brought pitas twice in a row. Both of these, you know, these kind of things are interested in pitas. And then
that's what I'm craving. Pitas.
I guess they don't have that on the hospital menu, I guess.
Well, if you ever make a grilled pizza, if you ever have a simple grilled pizza recipe for the dough, if you actually put it on a grill, it like, you know, a very simple pizza recipe, you know, pizza dough recipe, you put it on the grill and it gets little grill marks, but the way it heats up, it almost becomes like a puffy pita.
Right, because it steams, like the water inside from the grill is going to steam and heat up and blow up. Yeah, for sure.
So these are kind of basic breads. But yeah. I want to ask you, you do this thing, let's just keep going. Your sumo stew, something you do with Michael Harlan Turkel.
Sure, so, it's funny you bring that up. So Michael and I were just planning the next sumo stew is going to be in November at the Brooklyn Brewery. We've done it at the Brooklyn Kitchen for years. We've done it there a lot because, again, you point out we do have space, right? And if you have space in New York City, that's the thing that's hard to come by. We do like to do it in other somewhat larger venues, and Brooklyn Brewery has been a great supporter of it. Sumostew.com is where you find out about it, but it is a really fun, really big food event celebrating Japanese food and sumo culture. So in Japan, the sumo tournaments are a huge deal. They're 15 days long, and they happen 6 times a year. That gives us lots of opportunity here in the U.S. for having events. And the event is centered around watching sumo. It's very rare to be able to see sumo in the United States. Now, this isn't live. We don't have sumo wrestlers here yet. It's on my agenda for the next few years. Back in the 80s, they did an exhibition at Madison Square Garden. I actually, a couple years ago in Japan, met a former sumo wrestler who'd been at MSG in the 80s and had wrestled there. And so I was talking with him about how he's a coach now. Could we get it to come back to New York? But, you know, sumo is a sport where, you know, we think maybe on the outside these guys are just like big fat guys running into each other. I mean, they're incredibly strong. They're incredibly well-trained. There's a ton of technique that goes into it. You know, these guys weigh 350, 400 pounds. They can do 50, 60 push-ups without even like a blink. So if you imagine how hard it is to push-up if you weigh 160, imagine how hard it is to do a push-up if you weigh 400 pounds, right? You're adding an extra 240 to that push. At sumo matches in Japan, it's an all-day event. You know, there's 8 hours of matches every single day. People go, they sit, they eat, they drink beer. So the same thing happens at Sumo Stew. Your ticket gets you a bento box, and we involve local restaurants. So we try to have 5 different restaurants. They each prepare a dish. And we have sponsors, much like a lot of your events, Jimmy, where we get tofu from, Hodo Soy in California, and we get meat sometimes from Heritage Foods USA, from Patrick, sometimes from Happy Valley Meat, other places, and we get noodles from Sun Ramen, and then we provide that to the restaurant, so the chef makes a dish for the bento. Then you come in, you get beer, obviously, of one kind or another. In this case, coming up November, will be the Brooklyn Brewery. We've done it at Magnolia Brewing in San Francisco, had their beer on tap for that event. There's Nika Whiskey has been a supporter since the very beginning, so there's always a whiskey cocktail made by some great bartender from the area, from New York in this case. Then we have Mizu Shochu, who are a shochu supporter, so they come and they pour shochu. And then we usually have some non-alcoholic beverages as well. We usually have some tea. We have a range of different tea importers that we've worked with over the years, and then some other, you know, Japanese sodas and that kind of thing. And then the dish for which the event is named is chonkonabe, which is sumo stew. Chonkonabe is a very hearty stew that the wrestlers eat every day pretty much, and it's really just a mishmash. It's whatever they have around. Sometimes it's pork meatballs with vegetables. It's always a mixture of vegetables and meat in this very hearty stew. It's eaten with rice. They eat bowls and bowls of it, and so we have somebody, you know, some restaurant make it and serve it out of a huge pot, and basically you get a bento box, you get a couple of drink tickets, and you get as many bowls of chonkonabe as you want to eat. Traditionally, chonkonabe is made from chicken, because as I said to you the last time I brought you lunch, I brought you chicken, because the sumo wrestlers eat chicken on match days because they want to stay on their 2 feet like a chicken. So I was hoping that by feeding you chicken last week, that would help you to be able to stand up longer on your feet.
So fish on the other days, but chicken on the match days.
Yeah, exactly. Chicken on the match days. And, you know, and it's a big party, and we watch matches, and we, you know, we have a big raffle. You know, we always try, I always do, and I know you do too with your food events, to always try and have there be some kind of donation or supporting aspect of it, whether that's to folks who don't have food or to some nonprofit. In the case of Sumo Stew, we always do a raffle. Usually it's to help the Japan Society, great nonprofit that supports Japanese culture here in New York.
That's great, man. And shochu.
Yeah. I mean, shochu is really coming up. I just recently tasted the first shochu distilled in New York City. Last week, actually. There's a tiny little shochu company that's starting up inside of Moto Spirits. I don't know if you know those guys out in Bushwick. They have a tiny little still, and they make these Southeast Asian-inspired spirits. I guess the one of the founders was motorcycling through, I think, Cambodia, and came into this village, and they had this like still, and they served him this distilled apple beverage. And so they started making it here. So these guys are as an offshoot of that are making shochu.
And talking about Japanese culture, the sake place in Sunset Park, Brooklyn Kura.
Yeah.
Have you been over there?
I have. Did you have a chance to go before you?
It's on my list. It's one of the places I want to get them on my show.
I can connect you to them. They're wonderful. Their sake is some of the best, I think, in the world. So, I mean, it's saying a lot for a couple of American guys making it in Brooklyn. But, you know, everybody that I've brought there, Japanese or not, has absolutely loved it.
Local fresh sake.
Yeah, it really is. And their tasting room in Industry City is really, you know, it's a beautiful space. And you can try some stuff that you really can't get outside Japan. You can get Moromi, which is like the first, you know, the very beginnings of the sake process, where it's really fresh fermented and hasn't been aged at all. And basically they just pour that right out of their fermenters and you can taste it, which is something you really can't get unless you go to a sake brewery.
All right, man.
Awesome. Well, thanks, Jimmy, for letting me come down here
and
bother you.
Thanks for inviting me on.
I think you have some more physical therapy to get to, and we'll see you back in the studio soon.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for listening to Feast Your Ears today. You can find Feast Your Ears as well as lots of other great shows at heritageradionetwork.org, on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Please do me a favor and leave a review of the show if you liked it, and you can reach out to me if you have any questions, harry@thebrooklynkitchen.com. You can find me on Instagram @thefoodballer. Talk to you next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.